I would just remind everyone that, and oh, and he's also, Paulo has asked me to actually show his introduction because he's concerned that people sometimes don't understand him. I say that's nonsense, but I will do the asks, and I will show my screen and show what he's going, how his introduction. And also I just ask everyone at this point, please mute your computers because it makes the sound much better. Paulo, go ahead.
Okay. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce Vittorio Gallese, who is a friend of mine and lives in the same town where I live, Parma. As you know, he belongs to the team of researchers who in the 90s discovered mirror neurons. However, he will not talk specifically of mirror neurons. Actually, when I told him, he said, please don't let me talk about mirror neurons. I'm tired of that, you know. But of a topic he's investigating right now and is more involved with. I tried to invite him already in the past years, but he could not come because of he had other commitments. Originally, I had in mind to ask him to talk of an interest he had at that time, namely of the application of mirror neuron discovery to films, visual art, and literature. But later, he moved on to new interests, and it is on these interests that he will talk today. It is impossible to mention the many aspects of Vittorio's professional career. I will mention only a few things. He was graduated in medicine at the University of Parma, Italy, where he is now full professor of psychobiology at the Unit of Neuroscience. He is currently also Einstein Fellow at the Berlin School of Mind and Brain of Humboldt University, and is also adjunct senior research scholar at the Department of Heart History and Archaeology of Columbia University of New York. He received many honors, impossible to cite them all. I mention only the Sol Menninger Chevrin Prize. Chevrin was our member, given to him last year in Brussels from the International Neuropsychoanalysis Society, an award where the priority is given, I quote, to research paradigms that connected to empirically testable areas of Freudian classical metapsychology. In 2013, he received an important award, the Musatin Prize, from the Italian Psychoanalytic Society. And in 2010, in New York, the Arnold Pfeffer Prize for Neuropsychoanalysis from the International Neuropsychoanalysis Society. And in 2007, he received from the University, from the discoverer of mirror neurons, the Grohe-Meyer Award of Psychology for Psychology from the University of Louisville. This is an important award. In the past years, it was received, for example, by Antonio Damasio, Albert Bandura, Aaron Beck, and Daniel Kahneman, who came here last year. Vittorio Gallese's main interests are in cognitive neuroscience, experimental aesthetics, neuropsychology, psychopathology, and philosophy of mind. Is the editorial board of several journals, among them Neuropsychoanalysis, Cognitive Neuroscience, Social Cognitive and Affective Neuroscience, Phenomenology of the Cognitive Sciences, Philosophical Transaction of the Royal Society B, etc. The research activity of Vittorio Gallese since the beginning focused on the relationship between the sensory motor system and cognition, and on the way the brain represents space, the visual motor processes presiding over reaching to grasp actions and action understanding. In more recent years, he broadened his interest research on the neurobiological basis of intersubjectivity, empathy, aesthetics, language, and theory of mind. He also applies the neuroscientific method to study autism and schizophrenia. He has been involved in multidisciplinary collaborations with other disciplines, like philosophy of mind, cognitive linguistics. For example, he collaborated with George Lakoff, among others, aesthetics, narratology, and psychoanalysis. Probably you know the two papers we wrote together with Morris and me. And he wrote many other papers in psychoanalysis, in psychoanalytic journals. And he developed the embodied simulation theory, which is a unified model of basic aspects of intersubjectivity. Finally, I want to say one aspect of Vittorio that I admire, and I have to say also envy, that is being a real intellectual, By this I mean that he has wide interests also in other fields, such as art, music, literature, and the humanities in general. To this regard, I want to mention another prestigious honor that is outside our field. In Parma, our city, there is an exclusive club called Club of the 27, where 27 is the number of the operas by Giuseppe Verdi, who was from Parma. In that club, there are 27 men, no women, each named with the title of one of Verdi's 27 operas. When one of them dies, another man is elected in this prestigious club. Well, Vittorio has been elected to be part of this elite of Verdi's fans, and he represents the opera The Lombards of the First Crusade. So I introduce you The Lombard of the First Crusade, Vittorio Gallese. His paper is titled Habits, Social Practice and Symbol Making, a Just So Story. So.
Thank you so much, Paolo, for this very kind and most generous introduction. And let me also thank your group for the privilege of being invited to share with you some of the ideas that I recently developed on this fascinating topic, which is the origin of meaning making, the origin more narrowly of symbolic objects. As you may have noticed, I choose a rather minimalist title because I think this is a very complex issue. What I'm bringing in is my attitude of a neuroscientist, and our habit is to look at big problems like looking through a peeping hole, trying to test whether the addition of our empirical perspective may shed new light on topics, issues we are debating since we have an historical record of our past. So if you allow me to do so, I will now try to share my screen in order to show my slide. Okay, can you see the slides? Okay, great.
Yes.
Thank you. Habit, social practice, and simple making, a just so story. Let me start with a quote from Sigmund Freud, a very debated book he authored in the earlier part of the 20th century. But I think that hopefully will make sense even more at the end of my presentation when I will come back to the psychoanalytic perspective on these issues. The quote is the following, begin quote, "We are thus prepared to find that primitive man transposed the structural conditions of his own mind into the external world." This notion of externalization will be a kind of common trail along all of my presentation. First of all, let me tell you in a few words why this topic should bother someone like me, a neuroscientist. Well, if cognitive neuroscience is supposed to investigate the human mind, human cognition, the human psyche, we can choose a variety of concepts and words to designate what we take willy-nilly to represent one of the distinctive features of our species. Well, if this is the case, culture, aesthetic, what we now designate as art, should be one of the most investigated topic by this empirical perspective. Unfortunately, this is not so. To make things worse, you don't know how often I've been approached by colleagues, by other neuroscientists, trying to convince me that empirical investigation of art and aesthetics is something that at best you should do when you are close to retirement age. I'm still 9 years ahead of my retirement age, and I started investigating these issues about 13 years ago. So I never decided to stick with this advice, which I take to be totally wrong. But let me add also that it is a really difficult enterprise, in spite of the fact that many people claim that we should move towards a more interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary or even transdisciplinary attitude towards these topics. Reality is rather different. This interdisciplinary approach is systematically discouraged by the vast majority of scientific journals, by academic circles, both in the field of neuroscience and in the field of the humanities. And in my experience, where I had less to struggle to get this stuff published was at the time where I tried to hide the best that I could this interdisciplinary approach, trying not even to mention words like aesthetics or art. Nevertheless, I don't care. I keep going. And if we were to think about distinguishing aspects of what it means being human, these two images that you see in the slide perhaps portray some of these most distinctive traits. We are obsessed, literally obsessed, by man-made images and by stories. We create images, we create stories, we narrate stories, we enormously enjoy being told stories, we enormously enjoy watching images. These images are very different from the other images that populate our perceptual world. These man-made images are charged emotionally, affectively, intellectually, and what we read in the news these days about statues being torn down all around the world is a further epitome of the incredible power of images, just to quote the title of a famous book of a friend of mine, David Friedberg, who's also living in New York, as we speak. Let me briefly make a snapshot on narrative behavior by quoting from a book of Michele Cometa. Michele Cometa is a professor of comparative literature and visual culture at the University of Palermo in Italy, and recently published this book, Why Stories Help Us Living, the Necessary Literature. Beginning of the quote, the narrative behavior has in fact given shape and strongly conditioned the development of the cognitive abilities of Homo sapiens. And therefore studying the narrative means having access more or less direct to the functioning and structure of the human mind, and with the mind also of consciousness. So when we speak of language, when we speak of narrative, of course, we refer to one of the most distinctive features of our species, which is the linguistic competence. Language has been investigated in the last 70 years, mostly if not predominantly from its formal point of view. There has been a lot of emphasis on recursion, on the normativity of language, on generativity. From Chomsky onward, the formalization of language has been mainly driven, also the empirical research in a variety of fields and disciplines. However, since language wasn't created in Mr. Chomsky's office, I think we should keep a wider and more open approach
to the topic of language. And here I'm quoting from an Italian philosopher, Paolo Virno, who published a book 10 years ago on language and recursion, and where I quote from, before rules, wrote Virno, says Wittgenstein, we find a preliminary regularity. By this term, we must mean the bioanthropological background. So people like me are specifically investigating within an anthropological frame of reference, this bioanthropological humus from which in the development of the cultural evolution of our species, language and symbol making emerged. This is going to be the outline of my talk. I will talk briefly about the paradigm shift we are all in as we speak, the biocultural turn. Then I will briefly speak about culture as an advanced cognitive technology. I will introduce performativity and motor cognition. And finally, I will get to the core of my talk, the creation of symbolic object as ritualized performativity, and then some preliminary conclusion. As Verdi mentioned already, Giuseppe Verdi already mentioned by Paolo in his kind introduction to my talk, used to say, when inquired about how to possibly reform the curriculum in a music school at his age, let's go back to the past and a progress will ensue. I think this rule can be applied no matter what. Actually, it can also be very dangerous in some respect. But I think it beautifully applies to the topic we want to talk about this morning. Here I'm quoting from Johann Gottfried Herder. In 1795, he wrote, knowledge proceeds from the senses and from the experience of the surrounding world, and all refers to it. Without limbs and organs, without imagination and memory, the mind has nothing to work with, reason has nothing to elaborate, symbolic creation has nothing to express through science. So this clearly means that if we want to deal with symbols, language, culture, we cannot leave the body out of our hypothesis. So the rhetoric question I'm asking myself and I'm asking you is the following. Can we finally, at last, the rigid dichotomy that separates culture from nature, competence from performativity, Naturwissenschaft from Geistwissenschaft? I think the time has come. Why? Because we can consider culture as an extension or outgrowth of the natural. Many of these ideas and intuition have been out there since centuries. What is remarkable now is that this attitude towards a complete new vision about the relationship between these two dimensions of being human, nature and culture, are being addressed, discussed, quite often endorsed by a variety of scholars belonging to very different disciplines. The biocultural paradigm posits that any human technology is at the same time the expression of the human mind and of human's bodily nature, as the latter scaffolds the former. So culture can be described as a naturally evolved type of human cognitive technology, and human cultural evolution is thus conceived as a dynamic process of cognitive technological development. A full understanding of the intimate relationship between nature and culture, however, in my opinion, requires two very important preliminary steps. The first step is the following. We must frame humans and their cognitive life within their umwelt, to use an expression coined by the biologist von Uexküll. These immediately make you aware of where I position myself. I position myself as a relational realist, to use Georg Northoff's expression that I totally embrace, share. Namely, to focus in the first place on the relational nature of human beings and therefore of the human mind. One possible way to talk about this aspect is by quoting John Dewey, who wrote, "We are willing under hypothesis to treat all of human behavings, including his most advanced knowings, as activities not of himself alone, but as processes of the full situation, organism, environment." The second important step we should take, if willing to address from a biocultural perspective, this double aspect of human nature, the natural and the cultural one, we should resist the temptation to draw a sharp line separating material from non-material culture. James Gibson, mostly known nowadays for his pioneering notion of affordance, in the sense is considered as perceptual system that he published in 1966, wrote, "Culture evolved out of natural opportunities. The cultural environment, however, is often divided into two parts, material culture and non-material culture. This is a seriously misleading distinction, for it seems to imply that language, tradition, art, music, law, and religion are immaterial, insubstantial, or intangible, whereas tools, shelters, clothing, vehicles, books, are not symbols, are taken to be profoundly different from things. No symbol exists except it is realized in sound, projected light, mechanical contact, or the light." Very clear. More recently, Randall White, who is an archaeologist in New York, at New York University, in 1992 wrote, "Two modern anthropological themes have been entirely missing from the literature on the origin of art. A broader concern with material culture and a sophisticated formulation of the notion of the social construction of meaning. As a result, articles on the origin of art usually end up by speculating about the process by which art was discovered, rather than illuminating the broader social, technological, and ideational contexts and processes that made complex representational systems possible, desirable, and useful." More recently, Lambros Malafouris, who is a Greek archaeologist based at Oxford University, who is recently proposing the theory of material engagement, in 2015 wrote, "We need to reclaim the study of mind and its evolution from the detrimental influences of cognitivism, evolutionary psychology, and neo-Darwinism, arguing for a continuity of action between brain, body, and culture, and the primacy of material engagement." But the thinker that I think is more illuminating when considering the evolution of human culture as a form of cognitive technological development is a thinker that I do not know how popular is in the English speaking world. I don't even know if his opus has been translated into English, who is Gilbert Simondon. Gilbert Simondon was the supervisor of Merleau-Ponty for his doctoral thesis, and I think has incredibly modern ideas on these topics, ideas that in the English speaking world has been very recently echoed by the cognitive archaeologist Jan Hodder with his notion of entanglement. Unfortunately, it doesn't pay any tribute to Gilbert Simondon and to his ideas, although their perspectives are remarkably similar, if not identical, in many respects. According to Simondon, technology exceeds any narrow utilitarian purpose. As technology expands, it produces new relations between people and things, or between people and people, or between things and things. Technology, in other words, is a network of relations. Far from marking our alienation from the natural world, technology is what mediates between humankind and nature. So the idea is that, as I said already, human cultural evolution is a dynamic process of technological cognitive development. And this man-made image is trying to capture what I mean. On the left hand, you see this hand axe, probably 200,000 year BP old, which is a remarkable feature. It houses right at the center a fossil shell, and I will come back to this. To the right, you see an iPhone 7. So what I'm trying to say here is that the first prehistoric lithic instrument and iPhone 7, used among other things by Steven Soderbergh, one of my favorite movie director, to shoot Unsane, a remarkable movie he released in 2018, represent just two different temporally distinct expressions of the same technological dimension. Here is one of the most relevant book by Gilbert Simondon, Du mode d'existence des objets techniques. The technical object understood according to its essence, the technical object such that it has been invented, conceived, and desired and taken up by a human subject, becomes the support and the symbol of that relation we want to call trans-individual. By the intermediary of the technical object, an interhuman relation is thus created that forms the very model of trans-individuality. What's the role of cognitive neuroscience at this point? Cognitive neuroscience, in my opinion, can provide new concepts linking nature and culture by doing what? By studying the mechanism of the brain and body that support both the creative process and the reception of its results. By studying the brain body in relation to cultural artifacts and their reception, we can better understand the building blocks of aesthetic experience and the genesis of aesthetic concepts. One of the major arguments that are used to resist the possible heuristic role of natural sciences in general and of cognitive neuroscience in particular when addressing these issues like the one we are debating today, which are commonly taken to be the specific topic of the humanities, is that just by bringing up biology, neurobiology, neuroscience, a sort of Pavlovian reflex happens, which automatically equates this empirical neurobiological approach with determinism, Western centrism, colonialism, and the like. I think this point, this attitude totally misses the point, because maybe not known to many people in the humanities, but it is specifically using the tools of cognitive neuroscience that we can investigate cultural specificity, individuality, personal background, the role of cultural, political, historical, contextual factors. All these elements can and should come into the lab being part of what is being investigated, because this is possible. And even if not so popular among my colleagues, there are several of my colleagues, including myself, who are trying hard not to leave this important aspect out of the lab. So the biocultural turn and my specific approach is, in a word, trying to emphasize more relationality at the expense of the notion of identity, potentiality at the expense of actuality, processuality instead of givenness. So let me now turn to performativity as seen from the specific, narrow, schematic, coarse point of view of empirical cognitive neuroscience. I am a motor chauvinist, so let me be outspoken. I want to share with you this sort of intellectual coming out. I tend to see things predominantly from the point of view of action, of movement, and therefore, if we are dealing with the brain, from the point of view of the sensory motor system. To me, thought is mainly action. Perception is a specific modality of action and stuff like that. So I want to declare my intellectual prejudice on this sort of topics. The pivotal motor aspects of the bodily self, by bodily self, I imply the core most simplest, oldest, most likely from a phylogenetic point of view, most primitive from an ontogenetic point of view, inner part of the self. The bodily self, even if only bodily conceived, can be seen from a variety of point of view. I'm here focusing specifically on the sensory motor aspect, which includes also the affective one. So by speaking of motor aspects, I include under this umbrella entirely the affective and emotional dimension, which is definitely incredibly important, particularly in the early stages of our psychoaffective development. The pivotal motor aspect of the body itself integrate and anchor to a bodily first-person perspective the multimodal sensory information about the body and about the world the body interacts with. The self is open to the world because of the motor potentialities its bodily nature entails. This is what Merleau-Ponty was referring to when he was saying more important than the I think is the ich kann, I can. And he was designating this vast palette of motor potentialities with the notion of practognosia. The cortical motor system, long confined to the exclusive role of motor programming and motor control, indeed plays a crucial role in cognition, for example, in terms of the mapping of the space surrounding our body, our peripersonal space. The space, by the way, we are so much concerned now when trying to physically distance ourselves from others. The mapping of objects, of actions, emotions, both when physically present, this is very important, and also when only imagined. We have been, in the first half of my career, I've been dealing mainly with the macaque monkey brain, and I've been extensively investigated the frontoparietal brain circuits I'm talking about now. Frontoparietal motor areas are not just purely motor. This seriously questions any idea of the modularity of the brain if conceived strictly speaking, according to Jerry Fodor normative. Frontoparietal motor areas are neurally integrated not only to control action, but also to build an integrated, bodily formatted representation of actions, objects, locations to which actions are directed. So, in 205, actually in 203, although I started in 201, 3 years later, I published the paper with Alvin Goldman, Mirror Neurons and the Simulation Theory of Mind Reading. I progressively felt that Alvin's take on simulation theory was not properly, entirely, diligently describing what I had in mind from a functional point of view when trying to build a coherent framework to make sense of the variety of empirical data that I tried to briefly recap in the previous two slides. So I came up with the idea of embodied simulation. Basically, embodied simulation covers, on the one hand, the variety of mirroring mechanisms that we have been uncovering in the human brain, not only in the domain of action, but also of emotion and sensation, but it also covers other aspects of our relation to the world, namely our relation with objects, our relation with space, our imagination of visual or motor events and the like. So the notion of embodied simulation covers mirroring and intersubjectivity, but it's not confined to the intersubjective domain. It's a broader, has the ambition of being a broader notion of perception and imagination. Thanks to the activation of the mirroring mechanism, this has been our hypothesis from the very beginning, we can grasp the meaning of the actions, emotions, and sensations of other forms from within. This, of course, doesn't, people have claimed that we have said that we do everything just with a bunch of mirror neurons. I will name only one name to epitomize how our position has been poorly reported, mischaracterized, and the name is that of Hickok and his book, The Myth of Mirror Neurons. We have said something very different. We said, beside the standard cognitive inferential take we normally employ when trying to make sense of other individuals or of the world at large, we are enmeshed with, there is a more direct way of making sense of all these things, which heavily relies on the brain body, which doesn't necessarily require the use of language, of propositional attitudes, of false psychology, which of course it doesn't entail that language and what, cognitively speaking, is related to language doesn't exert a sort of top-down modulatory effect on this more primitive and phylogenetically old mechanism that nevertheless are still integral part of our take on reality. Thanks to the mirroring mechanism, we recognize in what we observe, motor goals, intentions, emotions, sensations, without necessarily having to use the inferential reasoning in linguistic form. Perhaps, if you pass me the expression, at this level, we use bodily inferences. Let me now come to the core of my talk today. Hand, signs, and the brain. This beautiful object, this little piece of ochre with this mysterious geometric incision is 70,000 years old, has been found in a cave near Blombos in the proximity of Cape Town in South Africa, and has contributed to, in spite of a lot of debate, discussion, to rewrite the history of the origin of symbolic objects and culture as we speak, which is a history that basically has to be rewritten almost on a daily basis as new specimens are being found all over the world. We toyed with a very much Western-centric idea that if humans came from Africa, culture came from Europe, referring to the beautiful paintings of the caves discovered in the south of France and Spain, Chauvet, Lascaux, Altamira, and the like. Things most likely are very different. This piece of ochre with this engraved geometric lines apparently tells another story. So it's about this story that I will mostly concentrate in the remaining part of my talk. This is an experiment that we did a few years ago, and we wanted to test to which extent our perception of symbolic signs like Roman alphabet letters, Chinese ideograms, contrasted with scribbles, engage something more than our visual apparatus. Namely, we wanted to test whether this handwritten sign also engage our motor part of the brain. And the answer we got from these experiments is positive. When we are observing this handwritten sign, we see an activation of the motor cortex of the beholder in spite of the fact that her or his muscles of the hand, of the forearm, are totally silent, as we documented by simultaneously recording from the brain with EEG and from the muscles with EMG. Another interesting aspect of the results of this experiment is that these particular stimuli, alphabet letters and Chinese ideograms, evoked a stronger motor simulation in the brain of beholders than scribbles, in spite of the fact that all our participants were native Italians, totally not knowing the Chinese language. But nevertheless, there are features in this stimuli, some gestaltic aspect that, this is a very very wild hypothesis, they might share some kind of kinematic property that is unconsciously detected by our motor part of the brain and therefore activating the motor part of our brain more than scribbles. This is an experiment where we presented to our beholders digital reproduction of the cats on canvas by Lucio Fontana, or like in another experiment, the brush strokes of Franz Klein, comparing the brain activity of beholders when watching these artworks, when watching control stimuli that we obtain using Photoshop, wiping out all the dynamic aspects of the stimuli while keeping their gestaltic basic feature. And again, the result shows that when we behold these images, we simulate the gesture that produced those very same objects. Okay, what has to do this with our being the symbolic species? I began by talking about human cultural evolution as a sort of dynamic cognitive technological evolution. It's really hard to separate in our the timeline of our species and the timeline of our predecessors. When utilitarian behavior gives way to symbolic behavior. Please have a look of this hand axe that was discovered in England in the South Thames region. It is apparently a hand axe, so a tool used to chop animal meat, to disintegrate other stones, to build other devices. But remarkably, in spite of the fact that it has been built following strictly a rule of symmetry, it mostly covers the hand covered by the human hand. It bears right at the center the fossil of a shell. Archaeologists and paleoanthropologists realized that the stones that were used to manufacture this object came from more than 100 miles from the place where they were most likely used and where they were found together with the human skeletons. So is this a tool or is it already an object charged with some symbolic meaning? Is it a status symbol? Is it something that tells us something about the identity of its owner? Derouagourin, one of the most prominent scholars who devoted his entire life thinking about the development of primitive thought and primitive art, made a very strong statement in 1957. The only biologically undisputable criterion to define the human dimension is the presence of the tool, l'outil. There are many different tools. Some of these tools are very old, about 2.5 million years ago from the Oldowan period. They belong to what we have been designated as Homo habilis. When we come closer to us in the Acheulean time, which is the time that the previous hand axe I show you belong to, we speak of Homo erectus, and we arrive the dawning of Homo sapiens. And finally, with these kind of objects, which combines the branch of a tree, a manufactured stone, and some vegetable used as a string, this technological evolution most likely, as it has been argued quite persuasively, in my opinion, is paralleled by a cognitive evolution. To build this thing, you must be smarter than to build those things. And so again, Cometa comes handy here. It must be said that the tools are also the product of a narrative behavior, such as the chaîne opératoire, Le Raguran was talking about. It is the application of a temporal and operational sequence, a before, a during, and an after, but at the same time presupposes a narration, because whoever creates an Olduvian pebble, a double-sided or a blade, must be able to foresee, to imagine, that a certain object may come out of a given stone, and therefore must have a rudimentary idea of time and the possibility of imagining, if nothing else, what cannot be seen. And much earlier on, Ernst Cassirer, who wrote a very interesting and very long treatise in four volumes on the philosophy of symbolic expression, wrote, "This world, the human world, forms no exception to those biological rules which govern the life of all the other organisms. Yet in the human world, we find a new characteristic, which appears to be the distinctive mark of human life. Between the receptor system and the effector system, which are to be found in all animal species, we find in man a third link, which we may describe as the symbolic system. This new acquisition transforms the whole of human life. As compared with the other animals, man lives not merely in a broader reality. He lives, so to speak, in a new dimension of reality." So, how do we move from a utilitarian behavior, making tools, to a symbolic behavior? And I think that the notion of habit, l'habit, according to Bourdieu, and the theory of social practice may be helpful to hypothesize a possible evolutionary scenario that makes sense of this shift. Pierre Bourdieu, 2000, a quote, "Social agents are endowed with habitus inscribed in their bodies from past experiences. These systems of patterns of perception, appreciation, and action allow them to perform acts of practical knowledge based on the identification and recognition of conventional conditional stimuli to which they are predisposed to react." In a way, I think this is very similar to the notion of implicit memories. A famous and dear late psychoanalyst and neuroscientist, Paolo Migone, and I are very familiar with Mancha, was speaking about in the last phase of his career. Implicit memories, non-repressed unconscious, there are several ways to designate this knowledge acquired through our being open to the world, acquired by experiencing our relation to the world, which leaves a trace both at the psychological, at the phenomenic, but also at the level. At some point in evolution, something absolutely new happened. Utilitarian behavior, as I've said before, led to the production of material symbols. The movements and actions that for hundreds of thousands or even millions of years have allowed the increasingly skilled and refined creation of tools and weapons, the killing of animals, the construction of shelters and huts, have also started to be used to create objects of a totally different type. Material object whose main purpose was to say and or represent something to someone else. How did the new cognitive ability to create material symbols emerge? One could speculate that the creation of material symbols is a sort of outsourcing of a pre-existing symbolic thought. I want to challenge this assumption, arguing that symbolic thinking and the creation of material symbols are not only naturally intertwined, but they determine each other. Once behavior turns into habits and mere actions give way to practice, social practices. A minimalist and neurobiological plausible approach to the origin of the creation of material symbols can benefit from the notions of habits and practice. What is a habit? Dewey on human nature and conduct. Habits may be profitably compared to physiological functions like breathing or digesting. The latter are, to be sure, involuntary, while habits are acquired. Another protagonist of American pragmatism, Charles Peirce, I think, is highly relevant here, even more than Dewey, because according to Peirce, habits give rise to symbolic expressions and produce meanings through what he defined as wood acts, that is, through dispositional potentialities that are both physical and mental. Does this notion of wood acts ring any bell? I think it does. Our brain body expresses the range of motor potentialities and relationship with the world that lead to the establishment of a relational self, modeling and delimiting the horizon of the world in which we live. We know and understand our world, our Umwelt, by virtue of the relational potentiality instantiated by our body. So, Peirce's notion of wood acts, I think, beautifully matches with an underpinning definition of the neural bodily machinery that underpins it in terms of what I said when I was speaking of sensory motor cognition. How are body potentialities or motor disposition transforming the production of symbolic objects? Let's turn for a while again to Bourdieu. The practice theory as practice insists, on the one hand, contrary to positivist materialism, that the objects of knowledge are constructed, not passively registered. And on the other hand, contrary to intellectualist idealism, that the principle of this construction is the system of structure and structuring disposition, the habitus, which is constituted in practice and is always oriented towards practical function. So according to Bourdieu's model, social practices are acquired through mimesis. And this is even more relevant to the neurobiological perspective of embodied simulation and mirroring mechanism I was referring to before. As argued recently by Monique Scheer from Tübingen University, in practice theory, subjects or agents are not seen as antecedent to the practices, but rather as the product of the practices. the subjects exist only in the context of the execution of social practices. The individual subject in practice theory is not conceivable without the body. The materiality of the body not only provides the place for the competence, dispositions, and behavioral routines of the practice, but is also the one on which and with which the practice works. The body is an actor and an instrument at the same time. So the body determines social practices, but at the same time, it's shaped by them. And it is within the reciprocity of body and social practices that cultural artifacts are indeed created. Therefore, the creation of symbols and the consequent cultural practices and institutions emerge from the implicit knowledge, the complex set of behavioral paradigms that individuals simulate and internalize mimetically due to the constant interpersonal relationship they have within the dense network of social exchanges with which they are intertwined from birth, or actually, I should add, even before birth, through the fetal relationship with the body of the mother. The anthropologist Alfred Gell died pretty early, and his book is in a way unfinished, but I think he offers an interesting perspective, although it has been criticized within the anthropological debate, particularly in France by Pierre Descola. But I don't have time to go into this debate. For the sake of the argument, I'll be happy to emphasize that, according to Gell, following Pierce, the cultural artifacts, the symbolic objects, and what we now designate as works of art are indexes. That is, agents endowed with intentionality that evoke abduction, which is a form of conjectural inference that goes from consequences to causes, allowing to appreciate the intentionality that led to their construction. So, if you think about abduction, the object as index, another bell rings immediately. Something similar, indeed, as I showed you before, happens in our brain when we observe The Cats by Lucio Fontana, where the consequences of the artist's action, the cats, lead to the motor abduction or simulation of their causes, the gesture of the hand that produces them. So again, Gell, before being a system of symbols, art is a system of action. Cultural artifacts exert an action on the world, and therefore art is a system intended to change the world rather than encode symbolic propositions about it. Visual art objects are not a part of language, nor do they constitute an alternative language. So, my hypothesis is the following: the progressive externalization of body representational formats, which originally, in the first place, evolved to allow our contacts with the real physical world, leads to the creation of symbols. Abstract externalization, derived from the representation of what is real, what is here and there, which find full expression in language, has its roots in transcending the body while remaining within its limits according to the mechanism of embodied simulation. The creative gesture that infuses material objects with meanings that transcend their immediate practical advantages could be the result of the fortuitous discovery of a single individual subsequently shared as a social practice by the other members of the social group, becoming, hence, the object of ritualized practices. So the Giasso story I'm making, that indeed was inspired by looking endlessly to this piece of ochre with this incision, is the following. An object like this could be the late translation of an individual fortuitous empirical observation. When cutting something on a rigid surface, the cutting activity leaves a permanent trace on it, thus revealing that the practice can persist as a material sign that supports it, even when the practice is over and its agent has long since disappeared. So this discovery could have been favored by the constant exposure to the relationship lived between traces of animals and absent animals. By the way, this is a behavioral strategy that we share also with the other animals, for sure. The deer footprint, for us, represent the deer, although the deer, it is not present. To a certain degree, the same experience might be shared by some predator. However, this observation may not have been sufficient to lead to the intentional realization of symbolic objects. You need something more to accomplish that than being merely exposed to the footprints left by an absent animal. Even if that footprint is enormously important for your own survival, because it leads you to a potential source of food. My hypothesis is that something more is needed to create this symbolic object, that is, the possibility of internalizing the causal relationship between action and sign by its actualization through one's own bodily action. A difference from the footprint left by the deer, those incisions are the outcome of my own bodily action. So this sort of potential fortuitous individual short circuit that led to the discovery, wait a minute, this is something that will remain of this stone even when I'm gone and I'm not cutting the skin of this animal as I was doing while leaving these traces. I wasn't realizing they were left on the stone. So the relevance of ritualization to cultural performances has been longly debated in anthropology. I think it might be relevant also for the Jasso story I'm telling you today, the expression of symbolic forms. Ritualization is a behavior we share with many other animal species. Actually, the definition in zoology of ritualization is the following. It is the evolutionary process by which an action or pattern of behavior in an animal loses its original function, but is maintained for its role in showing itself to the other or in other social interaction. And according to Darwin, in his famous book that he published in 1872, The Origin of Emotion in Humans and Animals, our emotions are the ritualization of preceding sensory motor behavior. Quite interesting in the perspective offered by Catherine Bell, an anthropologist who published a book on ritual. Bell's point is the following. Seeing ritual acknowledges powers beyond the invention of the community and implies correct and incorrect relation with these powers. It is often more likely to generate a social consensus about things. All this requires, of course, the presence of language. I'm not questioning that. Activities that are so physical, aesthetic, and established appear to play a particularly powerful role in shaping human sensibility and imagination. Examples of ritual-like behavior demonstrate the importance of the body and its way of moving in space and time. The body acts within an environment that appears to require it to respond in certain ways, but this environment is actually created and organized precisely by means of how people move around it. So you see, there is always this reciprocity between the practice, what the practice create, how they change the physical and the social world, and how the social and the physical world retroacts, feeds back on those social practices and behaviors. So through repetition, combination, memorization, the establishing of practices, of implicit memories, going through the process of ritualization, we finally establish the building of symbolic objects. So one might raise an objection at this point. Wait a minute. I mean, why are we focusing on symbolic objects and not on even more bodily activities that still bear a clear symbolic meaning. For example, what you see on the left side of this slide, an Aboriginal present time a ritual dance. So what's the difference as a symbol between the ritual dance and that piece of ochre? I think there is a very important difference. Ritualized performative practices can be symbolic too. However, they are confined to the iket nunc, to the here and now of the body. By means of performative symbolic externalization, reification, objectification, cultural artifacts surrender meaning from the temporal finitude of the body. And here, the psychoanalytic perspective, if I'm not getting it entirely wrong, is really useful. Here I'm quoting for a very interesting paper that Arnold Model published in 1970, The Transitional Object and the Creative Act. The created image invests an inanimate object with significance, but the image is not entirely a psychic process. What is created is not an hallucination. It is real. It is out there. I can hold it in my hand. I can carry it along with me. The notion that there is something intermediate between the attitude of the creator and the beholder approaches Winnicott's concept of the transitional object rights model. The interpenetration of the actual environment, here is he is referring to the painted caves of Lascaux, Chauvet hadn't been discovered yet, where sometimes you realize that those images have been painted specifically in that position of the cave by exploiting the physical feature offered by the belly of the mountain, so that the physical world and the symbolic representation sort of intermingle, interpenetrates, make something which is stirred through the intermingling of the two, what is inside my mind and what is already out there. The interpenetration of the actual environment, and I'm not even daring to elaborate on the sexual aspects of this process of interpenetration, that is the walls and the ceilings of the cave itself, with the created image right model, may represent an externalization of a psychic process. The child's first creative relationship with the environment, which Winnicott has described as the transitional object and transitional phenomena, the potential space of development. I would interpret the Paleolithic artist's use of the actual formation of the cave walls and ceiling themselves as a concretization of the interpenetration of the inner and the actual environment. That is, the artwork itself is a tangible expression of the psychology of the creative process. This is something that we are not able to find in the ritual dance and the like. Not even in narratives, in the rhapsodic tradition of tales and fables. It has to do with the object, with a physical object. The cultural transformation of the environment may be understood in part as a process modeled on the child's relation to his primary environment, that is, his mother. Separation anxiety provides the motive for the child's first creative play, and separation anxiety, to which the fear of death is added, may also be the motive for the institution of a magically created environment. Both symbolic processes serve to mitigate the experience of total helplessness. And I think there are very clear biological roots to that, our being the most neotenic species. The most neotenic species means we are the animal species that is mostly dependent on the cure of others in order to survive and develop. So I'm done, just a few slides to reach what are not conclusion, but a final temporary point to what I tried to tell you today. Several important aspects of human cognition and culture share a performative character, that is, they qualify as mediated forms of action. Through repetition, combination, and memorization of particular shared behaviors and actions, and their mimetic ritualization, the social group, through reuse, infuses bodily practices originally evolved for more utilitarian purposes with new cultural meanings, symbolic meanings. The gradual transition that I propose from the creation of tools to the creation of symbolic objects shows that utilitarian and symbolic behavior are both chapters of the same trajectory of cognitive technology. I don't think nature is categorical. I think it's deeply dimensional. The same applies to psychopathology. So dimensionality is probably much closer to reality than our imposed useful categories that try to establish borders, to encapsulate meanings. It's very handy if I'm about to cook a dish to know conceptually by means of a category where to find the salt and the sugar. I don't need to go and taste that white powder every time. But categories sometimes can hinder our intellectual progress if we remain captured, locked in, so to speak, in what categories prescribe and predict. Second, it does not require us to assume that the creation of symbols is the late externalization of a pre-existing symbolic thought, because symbolic thinking and the creation of symbols are the co-constructive result of the development of shared practices and habits. And I'm ready to admit that this is probably the most debatable part of my tentative hypothesis. Finally, third, it is fully compatible with the neurobiological characterization of human relational potentialities as instantiated by the embodied simulation. And that's all about it. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I ask you?
Awesome.
Could you hear and see everything clearly?
Yes.
Good. So in spite of the content, at least its sensory vehicle, we're okay. Good. Great.
People can raise questions and also use the raise hand function if we get very busy.
Daniel.
Go ahead, David.
Should I unmute you? David, unmute.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
That brings up the whole topic of semiotics and how you bring that in. I think that's extremely important. And you mentioned Charles Sanders Peirce, who did a sort of larger program of that, in that he talks about the basic phenomenon of the sign as the most general thing, a sign being something that represents something other than itself, which I think goes back to St. Augustine or way back a long way. But as subtypes of the sign is the index.
Exactly. Which
actually refers to something by where it is or where it is in relation to the self and so on. And there's the icon, the icon representing by being similar to what it's representing. And the thing about index and icon is that they are determined by the nature of the object they're representing. the index of something like, oh, it's 5 miles away, or it's 2 feet away, has to do with where it actually is. There's no imagination involved. Now, the third thing is the symbol, which you are bringing forth in a very rich way. And the symbol isn't determined so much by the object, but by the language, by culture, actually. So that a symbol is imaginary in each language. So there may be many language which represent a horse by a different word. So that's sort of arbitrary what the symbol is. And I wonder if you think of these concepts in your model.
Thank you, David. I am quite reluctant to blindly embrace the notion of arbitrariness. I think nature is not teleological, but it's at the same time non-arbitrary necessarily. So the two things do not necessarily are co-determining one another. And there are several line of evidence, although they are definitely not mainstream. The mainstream view of languages from Aristotle, but that interpretation of Aristotle, katasmitheke, is also very debated among philologists. But nevertheless, from Aristotle onwards, we buy the idea that language is totally arbitrary. I don't think it is biologically plausible. There are actually some linguists that are trying to trace the roots of semantics at the level of the phonoarticulatory tract. So even before words, at the level of individual phonemes, they are mostly considered as lunatics within the larger cognitive linguistics community. I don't think they are by any means lunatics. I think they are on something. So that said, I don't have a thorough professional knowledge and understanding of semiotics to answer properly your question. What I was trying to emphasize in the last part of my talk is how comes that, in spite of all we might say or agree upon about the dependence, the constitution even, if you want to be really extreme, of our intellectual, cognitive, psychological activities on the body, we are so much obsessed by getting out of the body and tell something about ourselves, about our fellow humans, by getting out of the body and creating symbolic objects. I think the symbolic object accomplishes something, if you want, cognitively speaking, much more sophisticated and much more psychologically rich and interesting, also from an affective point of view, with respect of ritualized bodily movements like drumming or dances, just because of what I try to briefly emphasize in the last part of the talk. Just because you don't need the actualization of the body, you don't need the here and now of the body to say something to someone else. I think no one probably will be ever able to tell whether which stage of language development you need to have in place to do the dancing and the drumming and to produce symbolic object. If the two are parallel, they are coexisting, of if there is a temporal relationship between the two, and which is that temporal relationship, if any. I think that it's important to underline that we can look at this these very fascinating topics about ourselves, where do we come from, in a freer way with respect to what was possible 50 years ago, when all this debate had to be, in a way or the other, framed within a very rigid binary model, if you take structuralism on the like. I think there is a more ecumenic view on this topic, and this intellectual ecumenism, I think, is the outcome of the fact that we talk to one another much more often than we used to do 50 years ago.
Danielle, you're next.
Okay. So first of all, thank you very much for a very interesting and thought-provoking talk. In the beginning, when you talked about the embodied simulation, it made me think of Ernst Chris. I don't know how familiar you are with his work, but in 1952, in his book, Psychoanalytic Explorations on Art, he wrote about the aesthetic response as not only appreciating what one sees, but identifying with the process of art making in the artist, that we actually identify with the actual brush stroking or carving or whatever it happens to be. So I thought that that's really, and that you've found this, for example, in viewers of Lucio Fontana or Franz Klein, is what he was saying. And I always thought that he had something there when he talked about the aesthetic response. I also thought, so that wasn't really a question, I just wanted to know if you're familiar with his work.
I'm not.
You're not, yeah, it might be interesting. I also thought that, you know, you talk a lot about evolution, and our evolution is bringing us more and more to rely on technology. Look at us now with the, you know, the possibility of Zoom. We're more visual, I think, than ever. The younger generations are more and more visual. My students practically don't read, but they, you know, they're always online. They're always looking. And I've had to incorporate the visual much more in my teaching in order to reach them. I know that people have been complaining because of our seclusion recently of the lack of bodies, the lack of movement, the lack of bodies. The third thing I thought of is, this is moving it a little bit away from art. However, I'm thinking of another powerful social, cultural, symbolic phenomenon that is exploding on the internet, which is pornography. Internet porn, and how that, even though it's not considered art, although some people might consider certain aspects of it to be an art form, I wonder what your thoughts are about, you know, 90 million people visit Pornhub a day. 90 million. This is, you know, a huge sea change in our evolution also, and in terms of sexuality. And I'm wondering whether you have any thoughts about also the effects, both cognitive and motor simulation with regards to viewing internet porn.
Thank you. Very, very, very interesting points. The first answer, as I anticipated, no. I'm not familiar with his work. I mean, the idea that I, in a way or the other, identify with the artwork, or even better, that I explore the formal feature of the artwork from the inside, is the aesthetic of Einfühlung. And to tell you the truth, let me tell you this anecdote. I immediately, well, right after the discovery of mirror neurons, we all realized the potential relevance of this discovery for interpersonal relations and intersubjectivity. So I was I was very much interested to learn more on the notion of empathy. And by searching the web, using empathy as a keyword, I bumped into a paper published by one of your colleagues, I think the name was Brigman, in the International Journal of Psychoanalysis. The topic was, how comes that Einfühlung is used many times by Sigmund Freud in his books, but it never makes it to the standard English translation of his books. And through that paper published in the International Journal, I learned about a German philosopher I never heard of before, which is named Robert Vischer, who in the 1870s published a book on the role of Einfühlung in aesthetic appreciation of art. So that was what led me to contact David Friedberg, first reading his book, The Power of Images, and it's the main reason why I might be here today with you. I mean, it all started, my interest for aesthetics was triggered by that paper when commenting on the English translation of Einfühlung in the standard English edition of Freud's Magnum Opus, Robert Vischer and the aesthetic of Einfühlung was mentioned. Not only Vischer, but many other German scholars who established what has been later on designated as the aesthetics of Einfühlung, the younger Wölfflin, and many others. So just to say that there is a psychoanalytic fil rouge in a way that brought me here almost 20 years later. You mentioned the internet, the technological evolution that enables us to talk, to exchange views, to debate, to a certain degree, even to do psychotherapy, which is Zoom, the internet, and the web. But while at the same time, everybody complains that the real life is out there, there's something missing. What is missing? Well, there are many things missing. One interesting thing that is totally missing is the possibility to share the same physical space. I don't think it's just a matter of three-dimensionality. I don't think that I would be happier if instead of having a dialogue with your bidimensional image on the screen of my computer at home in Italy, I would confronting your three-dimensional avatars. I think the physical sharing of the same physical space, and particularly in therapy, adds something that cannot be restituted by a phone call, or even less probably by adding visuality to the dialogue with the patient. The last point you were raising is pornography. I'm not qualified to answer your question whether pornography is an art or not. I think it's a very, it's a question that whose answer changes dramatically if you take an historical perspective. I mean, if you hang around in Pompeii and you enter some houses, you have beautiful paintings depicting sexual acts in a very prosaic way in places that were most likely designated to perform sexual acts, paying money for doing that. They were kind of brothels or whatever you may call them. So from a neurobiological point of view, on the one hand, this is something neuroscientists still feel a sort of prudery talking about that. I remember the embarrassment of Giacomo Rizzolatti when a crew from a national TV channel, Rai Uno, member of the team of Piero Angela, who's a famous science divulgator in primetime TV, were so curious to establish a link between pornography and mirror neurons, Rizzolatti got really irritated and replied, with all the interesting things we have to talk about, why coming up with bloody pornography? And refused to answer that. In the paper I published with David Freeberger, we tried to be more liberal, and I think we quoted a paper that showed we were dealing not with mirror neurons, but with canonical neurons. So neurons that respond when I grasp an object, but also when I see the very same manipulable object, even without the intention to grasp it. And we were quoting a brain imaging experiments where a cohort of heterosexual male participants did not activate their motor cortex when seeing a penis in erection, while the cohort of gay participants did. So the affordance of an erected penis as a manipulable object led to motor simulation more in the male gay cohort than in the heterosexual cohort. To which extent they were, the heterosexual cohort was answering sincerely to the questionnaire that I suppose they were subjected to determine their sexual inclination, I wouldn't know. And also I wouldn't know how refined is the outcome that comes from such an experiment, because you must mediate the brain signal from 12 heterosexual and 12 gay. So this is a very coarse, but this is the closest approximation. Of course, when I see a sexual intercourse, I'm simulating it with my body, like I embody a botch max, a match of box or a soccer game or whatever. So sexual activity is no exception.
Thank you.
Great. I hope everyone can see the hand raising. And if you don't know how to use the function, you can raise your hand. Wilma, I see that you're on. If you don't know how to use the function, just raise your hand and I will put you in order. But right now there are several people ahead of you, Wilma. I will add you to the list. But next up is Mauricio.
What a magnificent tour de force. It's hard to take everything you've been telling us, Victorio, but I just want to mention, if it's not obvious for everybody, that what you're proposing is a really radical change in how we have understand cognitives and symbols. To take it back to kind of more psychoanalytic thought, the whole issue of that representational, that we understand the world through symbolic representational mental images is being challenged by the view, but that whole ability is based on an earlier capacity to understand the world and interactions with the world based on a more direct, immediate way of being able to understand the world through our bodies and through interactions with others. If I get the point, you mentioned Gallagher and as a kind of representative of that, where I think you belong. And another person I would think about is Hutto and his idea of a radical inactivist view of understanding the world. So this is a really radically different way to understand how we come to develop language and symbols, so that's just a preamble to what I wanted to say, which kind of takes me to a earlier talk we had heard on language, cognition, and meaning by Ray, who I hope is still here. And I was pointing out to him what he thought of some people who've been looking at the trying to understand the evolution of language, like Daniel Dorr and Eva Jablonka. Dorr wrote a book about language as instructing the imagination, and understanding language as a technical and social invention, you know, that evolved with cognition, but was a series of inventions that developed out of the necessity for humans to be able to develop a social technology to be able to understand ourselves in ways that would be able to and that led to symbols. His view, among others, says what this technology allowed us, just what you were saying earlier, that we're not limited to the here and now, like the rituals, but with symbols now we can go beyond the here and now and imagine things that we couldn't communicate about before. So he and Eva Jablanka, who've also looked at this from an evolutionary developmental perspective, are saying that this is the larger basis upon which we can imagine how language develops. So I wanted to get your thought about that. I have perhaps later on, I don't want to monopolize. If I have time, I'll ask you another question, but I'll just stop there so it doesn't become too complex.
Yeah, I mean, yes. I don't think, thank you for the nice thing you said about, I realize it doesn't sound too bizarre to your ears, what I tried to say. I don't know whether it is so radically ambitious. Actually, I tried to keep it very low. I think it still need to cook a little more and be developed further. I think what I try to do today is to show how it is possible to connect different intuitions, pieces of evidence, speculations that have been out there for a while. I mean, I'm not a philosopher. I'm not an archaeologist. I'm a bloody mechanics of the brain, after all. So, I mean, if I have an advantage with respect to this, which is not an advantage, it's a peculiar vantage point that enables me to see connections that probably are not so evident. If you go deeper than I could do, that I could go to address a given topic, but in going deeper, sometimes you delve so deep that then you have no light left, and you blind yourself to the depth that you have reached. So stay more on the surface, but adding a variety of perspectives, many of the which you properly emphasized in your comments to my talk. Sometimes I have the impression that you see a path you can follow, and this path sometimes when you are at the end of it, you realize that gives you an unexpected outcome, as it was for me when I realized thinking very long about this incision. My approach to the origin of language has known different phases. I mean, I've been fascinated by Walter Ong, by Havelock. So basically the idea that in order to accomplish a true abstract thought, true abstract conceptual thought, you need to invent a writing. So, you know, all the speculation by Havelock and Ong about how words were used before the invention of writing. They refers to Luria expedition in the Caucasus, the famous experiment where the illiterate would group the hand axe with the tree, with the saw, and the hammer would be left over, while the literate would put the saw and the hammer together, and the tree, the natural kind. Then I made the acquaintance to an Italian anthropologist working at Collège de France in Paris, Franco Severi. He is also a pupil of Levi-Strauss, but he studied the Kuna people in Panama, and his take on the issue made me think differently. His point is actually very the opposite.
if you are before the invention of writing, you need a conceptually more abstract mind in order to rule kinships, social relationship, to establish a hierarchy in the society. He has been spending his entire life, he's still very active, he's not retired, studying the transition from orality to literacy, and a very fascinating field of investigation that Michele Comete is now studying, that has been inspiring Abi Warburg, that has led Abi Warburg to visit the Smithsonian Institute and start his trip among the Navajo much later on when he was in the clinic of Binswanger writing The Ritual of the Snake, is exactly the possibility to starting not from Goethe and morphogenesis, but starting from Darwin, write a history of writing by developing it as a biological evolutionary process. So this for what pertains to the relationship between language and written symbols, which is much more complicated to me than it used to look when I was entirely relying on Havelock and Ong. The other thing I wanted to say in reply to your comments is that I'm not a radical and activist. I don't think that everything has to be out there. And I think that one of the unconscious reasons why I decided to focus on symbolic objects is specifically just because I feel that you can't get rid of the notion of representation, you can't get rid of the notion of content, as many radical and activists now maintain. I'm speaking of, is a good friend of mine, Dan Hutto, who's now in Wollongong in Australia, but he has been for a while in England, although he's in New York. I don't buy that we can dispense with the notion of content, with the notion of representation. I think the notion of representation has to be more ecumenical than as it used to be, particularly in the land of cognitive linguistics. There are formats of representation that are not linguistic, but they are bodily. And in that respect, I still totally agree with Alvin Goldman, who wrote extensively on representation and bodily form. But I'll stop here because there are other raised hands. Thank you. Thank you, Mauricio.
Larry, you're up.
That was a fascinating a talk and challenging to people like myself who have been wedded to the kind of opposite vision. So I want to ask you, because I'm perhaps polarizing too much. I imagine that you are saying, I'm thinking in terms of the quality of transcendence, which is involved a way of describing, I think, what's the variable at stake, something, an object that has transcendence in some fashion beyond its physical self or even its practical use, though that you indicate that may be a step toward transcendence. For it sounds like, and I may be incorrect, but I'll go on from this premise and you can correct me afterward, please, that you are saying in a way that the transcendence is a social transcendence, that the primary move toward this human capacity is ties somebody into an other person's and the group, that's the discovery, and that in a way is what art communicates and what that sort of creative expression does. Now, if one polarizes that and says to people, much more conventional people like myself, would say that the other kind of transcendence is a beyond the group and is indefinite in a way. And there I'm thinking the person that I revere so much in the past is Ernst Cassirer, whom you call I think very properly to your point. He contributes to it. I can think of him as very opposite to Dewey. And I think of him as sort of having a position that there is always for human beings at some point, and distinctive of them, the feeling that there's something beyond. There's something beyond what I see now. There's something to learn. There's a cause and so forth beyond it. I think Suzanne Langer, who's very close to what you're saying, also agrees with him. But I think
she was a pupil of Cassira, right?
Pardon? Well, your pupil. She was very much so, and elaborated in great detail. But the thing is, if I think now of what a lot of people here in the room are impressed by, which is infant development and the work of Tomasello and all the work of Susan Carey and people like that, of the native equipment of the very small infant, we are inclined to think, I feel, that the idea of transcendence is something that is more than a social connection, but is, and you're thinking of Tomasello's idea, is a setup for learning and inquiry and a continuous feeling of something beyond, which is what I think all of the objects of art and imagination and expression in human beings tend to have. That there's the idea of that you can learn, that the human being is a learning creature and assumes that there's something to be taught. Now, this is Tomasello, right? There's something to be taught, and that so that an object always, there's always a question beyond it and some possible suggestions of how to constitute an entity beyond, a cause beyond, something that moves beyond, something that has moved it and so on, which read back will constitute a transcendence from an immediate object or a movement to something beyond. Now, that standoff, can you tell me where I went wrong or how you see that opposition?
I'm in no position on such topics to say who's right or who's wrong. I mean, I don't even know if I'm right. What I try to do is to explore to which extent basing some hypothesis on the extant evidence, both in the domain of neurobiology, of developmental psychology, of psychopathology, but for the topic I was trying to address today, the record of paleoanthropology and archaeology, to which extent putting together the pieces, one can end up with a different mosaic with respect to the common wisdom, where, for example, that was dominating these fields when I started learning about the brain as a student in the late 70s. The picture was completely different. The picture of the baby was completely different. The idea about language was completely different. Chomsky himself went through quite an evolution in his thinking. If you consider the major step that must have been to him to publish the paper in 2001 with Fitch and Hauser about the linguistic faculty in the narrow and in the broad sense. Transcendence is distinctively human. We don't know to which extent we share this propensity, this projection towards something that isn't there, that we felt missing, and that we seek in a variety of forms and ways. It's hard to tell whether this is uniquely human, or even if some species of animal have a sort of animal god of animal place they like to be sometimes in their life. This way of thinking might seem paradoxical, but I mean, what we have learned from biology in the last 100 years, I think requires to be prudent to affirm human uniqueness in a variety of fields. For example, I'm ready to assign to some animals
the propensity to entertain representation. Think about the predator who's waiting for his prey when the prey isn't there. So he's waiting to do something about something he's thinking of, but in spite of his absence. When it comes to human transcendence, sincerely, well, the short answer to your very interesting question is I would know. The longer answer is that maybe it has something to do with something so basically emotional as the absence of the mother. And that refers again to our neotenic nature. I think people have been struggling what makes us unique. Of course, we have language, other animals do not have a language like our language. And so we have been facing Deus ex machina explanation, like the gene mutation, the grammar gene. Steve Pinker has been talking about gene FOXP2. It's a tale. It's a tale. It doesn't hold scientifically. I think we are the outcome of the fact that for a variety of reasons, bipedality, Erwin Strauss wrote beautiful pages on the acquisition of the bipedal stance, both phylogenetically and on an ontogenetic point of view. It dramatically changes your perspective on the world. So by raising on your hind limb, which is a biomechanical accomplishment, is incredible, incredible intellectual side effects, which is not just to liberate the hands. It's just a different perspective. The possibility to acquire an objectual perspective, a self, non-self, subject-object perspective, much more easily with respect to when you are a quadrupedal or a semi-quadrupedal. So when your perspective on the world is obliged to follow the main axis of your body, which you surrender from totally when you stand on your feet. So I think it's a very complex issue. So I would say that transcendence, our first transcendence is the absence of the mother we desperately seek, and the transitional object is a way to cope with that. So I think Winnicott and Model were on something, a book which I really liked, Imagination and the Meaningful Brain by Model, and not just because he was benign enough to quote Mirror News. That's not the reason why I like the book. I think this is it has to start with death, from our life, from coming out of the womb. I mean, you psychoanalysts, I think, have something to say, had something very relevant to say on that respect. How human cognition is so inextricably intertwined with our flesh and our being biological agents being developed inside the body of another biological agent. But I will stop here, otherwise it becomes even more nonsensical than it got so far.
Thank you.
Ray, you're up.
Hi, can you hear me now?
Yes, hi. I think we met a long time ago.
Yes, I think so. I first wanted to say, because it's very hard at the end of these things to actually say goodbye to people, so I just wanted to say how much fun this has been for me, and I hope that any of you who want to get in touch will indeed get in touch so we can discuss some of these matters further. Now, turning to your talk, Vittorio, there are about a million things I wanted to say to it, and it's very interesting, and I think we agree on a lot of things and disagree on a lot of other ones, but I'm just going to raise two things. The first one, I don't know if you were at my talk yesterday.
No, unfortunately, no. I was on another webinar.
Okay.
We are busier now than we used to be when we were traveling.
Right. Because it raised the issue for me, your talk raised the issue for me of what is different about looking at that piece of ochre as opposed to just a chunk of the same material. Yeah. And there's some difference in the way it feels. Sort of, it's imbued with, well, sort of what Larry called transcendence. There's something else about it.
Mm-hmm.
And this corresponds in some ways to the feature that I was talking about yesterday that I call a character tag of something being meaningful or not. And I applied it to nonsense syllables versus language, or nonsense visual field versus actually seeing figures in it. But suppose you find some object and you say, oh, there's something about this that's meaningful. I don't know what the meaning is, but it's meaningful. And it's not in the way it looks, it's in the way it feels to you. So it looks like, in terms of the mental representations of symbolic objects, it's the fact that they carry this feature of being meaningful. And so, and then you have to search for the meaning. And if you're learning language, it means, what's the meaning of this word? If you're learning a ritual, what's the meaning of this ritual, right? And so you're looking for patterns that are somehow meaningful, but it's just charged with something. And maybe there's a further feature that I mentioned yesterday about being, about it mattering, about it having some affective color to it, either, and that could be positive or negative. So it could be something that is imbued with positive feeling of mattering, or something that you really want to avoid. And it's not, and you know, if you extend that to the extreme case, you get sacred versus taboo, I suppose.
Yeah.
So we can think of this. What I'm trying to add to your story is, let's think of this in terms of the mental representations, how the brain codes that, which is your business. I'm not so concerned with at the moment, but just what the structures are that the brain is coding, what those data structures are like. So I think there's a point of contact here that is interesting for me, because it's extending this notion of meaningfulness to a richer set of domains, any sort of symbolic behavior. Whether you know what the meaning is or not, it's still charged with meaningfulness.
No, I fully agree with you. And indeed, that's what I was trying to say when I show you almost tachistoscopically, so to speak. That's like showing that experiment we made confronting the activation of the motor cortex of readers by showing them alphabet letters, Chinese ideograms, and scribbles. In spite of the fact that nobody could find any meaning in the Chinese ideograms, their brains' bodies were reacting differently to the signs with respect to the scribbles.
Right.
So indeed, we tried to discuss, but one of the reviewers didn't like our discussion of the data and asked us to include his own take on the issue. So our point was that since the motor brain reacts differently to graphic signs that share the same gestalt complexity, however, those that happen to be meaningful to somebody, not necessarily to the participants, evoke a stronger response from the motor brain than those that are not meaningful, it is possible that meaningful sign, no matter how transparent they are in their meaning, share some sort of kinematic primitives that are employed to draw them, that are not used to draw scribbles, and therefore, because of this motor resonance mechanism that we have uncovered, are picked up by the viewer, from the way, brain of the reader. The reviewer disagreed heavily and asked us to discuss an alternative explanation, which is probably more likely, namely that we are more exposed to meaningful signs than to scribbles. Therefore, the motor brain of the reader reacts more strongly to the meaningful signs than to the scribbles, not because the text but perceptual familiarity.
Right, yeah. But they've never been exposed to the Chinese character, so this notion of frequency is nonsense.
Exactly. So I think it's possible that there is some sensory motor primitive which foregrounds all possible meaningful signs that human beings were capable to invent.
Well,
Well,
suppose we say that there has to be something in the visual aspect of these things that triggers the idea that this is not random, that this is meaningful, right?
Yeah.
So we might have to, I mean, it would be interesting to sort of titrate the alphabet-like character of the displays and have a transition from alphabet-like to scribbles.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Find out what those parameters are.
Yeah, indeed.
But when it's something that looks orderly, like this, the inscriptions on the ochre, then you say this must be important. It must have been done deliberately. This wasn't accidental, and so
that was firmly established that it's the outcome of an intentional action of a human hand. There's no question about it. What does it mean? We'll probably never know.
Right. So my other question was about music. Just where do you see music falling in this view of things?
Well, I think one of the earliest objects that have been found is flutes.
Yeah.
So music is probably as old as the symbolic objects we are discussing this morning. And music probably has it's even closer to the notion of transcendence because it somehow, I don't know, I'm not an expert in the origin of music. I know you are a musician. If I remember correctly, you used to play the clarinet.
Still do.
Yeah, okay. So,
very good.
So you know a lot more of the psychology of music and a theory about music origin that I know of. I couldn't live without music, but it's a language in itself, and I know it's being debated to which extent this language overlaps or not with the spoken language.
But it's certainly got to be significant that rituals are so often accompanied by language.
Yeah.
And the relation of dance to music. And so on. I mean, there are various intertwinings of music with your concerns. I'm not sure how the whole thing works.
There's a friend of mine who's a musician, is a cello player. He plays in a trio, the Parma Trio. Used to play in Luzern in the early 2000 when Abbado was conducting there. And he teaches in Mozarteum in Salzburg. He's obsessed by the notion of musical universals. So he's struggling to see to which extent it would be possible to do empirical research on music universals. When we meet, he wants to talk about that. I'm trying to convince him I'm not the right person. Because
there's a paper in Science that just came out about that with a cultural survey of, I don't know, 80 different cultures or something like that, and there are like 75 authors on this paper.
Okay.
Because they went out and did the field work.
Yeah, so do you believe in universals in music?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Lerdahl and I wrote about that in our book back in 83, and I don't see too much reason to
contradict that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a question of exactly what they are and what the parameters are that can vary, but we talked about that in metrical systems and tonal systems and so forth. I think there are deeper things now about narrative structure in music.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to end on time, we have about 20 minutes left. I have five people lined up. Bonnie, and then I'm going to insert Wilma after Bonnie because her hand was raised, and then David, Ann, and Larry. We have about 20 minutes if we're going to end on time. So, Bonnie?
First of all, I'm not seeing. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. I can hear you, yes.
Yes.
First of all, I want to say how really terrific your talk was. I touched on so many important aspects that are important to me, and also touched on some of my favorite figures, like Bourdieu, who I've written about, and don't really understand why his work isn't more known among the analysts, because I think it is, as you say, very important, the notion of habitus and so on. And you're talking about the mediation between the receptor and effector. Reminds me so much of Luria's in The Working Brain, where he talks about the sign system and Pavlov's second signal system, which introduces the notion of signs. So, and then Peirce, of course, which his body of work is all about signs and the complexity of sign systems. So I guess one of the problems I have with the way, coming out of a kind of background in linguistics, but also semiotics and a belief in the, and sort of this follows up, I think, maybe what some of what David was talking about, the utility of having a kind of broader semiotic to look at things across many different disciplines. For example, there's a group on that came out of von Ixkill's work on the Umwelt and Invoke called biosemiotics. And that's a fascinating group that you may know, where they're dealing with the viruses. They're dealing with immunology and how does the virus, you know. So they take up the notion of representation in such a more interesting way, I think, as not so much a thing, but as an active interpretation. That so it's a process.
Yeah, yeah.
More than an entity, and so that leads me to the brick, and that the brick is, in a Peircean terms, not only it has all of the three dimensions that Peirce always talked about. It is a thing. It is an image, an icon. But it also, when you encounter it, has a it's an index. It strikes you. You have to pay attention to it, and then it can have meaning, and that meaning can be only as a thing, or as an index, or like the deer footprint can be an index, and perhaps over time it shifts. And I think that was part of what Piaget was trying to say about semiotics function developing in the child, that at first some things which the child was hearing only iconically, the sounds, began had take on a more indexical dimension. It wasn't that the sounds didn't have all three dimensions to begin with. Certainly for the mother, they do. They're symbolic and all of those. But the child comes to the different, to rearrange the three dimensions of Peirce, the firstness, secondness, and thirdness, the potentiality, the actuality, and not so much that the symbol is arbitrary, but that it has a social dimension, that they involve another person. So, so I think it's just both Bourdieu's work and Peirce's work, I think, really give an enormous richness that we could use. But I want to ask you from my own question, which you bring up in terms of, you make a distinction, you say in terms of habitus or practice theory, it's not that the agent and the subject are antecedent to practice, but that it's a product. And this is something that's a question, and I'm interested to know the neuroscience foundation of this sense of always beginning, all our theories begin with an agent. One thought I had was that we're all nominative accusative language speakers, which places agency. And if we were all ergative language speakers, we would be looking at the world very differently.
Oh, where, for sure.
Which is where there isn't this division.
I entirely agree. Language is shaping our world.
Right. So is that once we learn a language, we get a narrative, does that affect how we then try to explain everything else?
Yeah.
That's my question, I guess.
Well, I no question about the cosmogonic power of language. I fully agree. I mean, just because I'm a bottom-up chap, trying to see things from how do you get to a certain level of cognitive sophistication doesn't entail that I'm denying the major role that cognitive sophistication is producing on us and on our existence, quite the opposite. I think that the idea that the development of self-identity is a process, and it's the outcome of a constant negotiation with the world, and particularly with the relationship that we are able to establish with the others, can be hardly disputed. I mean, it surfaces in a variety of germane fields, from the work done by people like Ed Tronick or Stern or Colwyn, Trevathan. I mean, when I show the video footage of the steel face footage of Tronick experiments, I always looking at the facial expression of the women in the hall and how they start to feel uneasy the more the child develops his reactions. Mm-hmm. They start laughing when the child makes faces, and then that laughter turns into uneasiness and even a situation of total discomfort as soon as the child starts crying, etc. So they are mirroring what they must be going on in the mind of the mother trying hard to remain still. And from the point of view of the brain, I think, I shouldn't say it myself, but I think that our discovery of mirror neurons was a turning point, because it demonstrated how much, even at the subpersonal level, this dependence on others is so pervasive, even at the level of neurons. It has been discovered recently, even in rodents, when rodents inspect, see another rodent being in physical pain, they activate part of their brain that normally activates when they themselves are in a painful situation. So it's a very old mechanism that can be spotted in different species, and most likely in singing birds, for example, in different species, accomplishes different functions. And even in the case of human beings, in the course of the evolution of primates, I think this mechanism has something to do with language and acquired different function. It's been accepted, to use a Stephen Jay Gould expression, to serve different purposes. But I know very little on the brain, and I make mine Wolf Singer recently said. He said, I think I know much less about the brain now than I did, or than I thought I did 40 years ago. And I totally share his impression. One of the few things that I think I learned in 40 years of daily acquaintance with the brain is that relationality is one of the key words I'm ready
to carry with me forever.
Thank you.
Wilma, why don't you go? And again, we have several people that want to speak. Just keep that in mind when you're asking your question.
Yeah, and I have to keep it in mind too. I tend to elaborate on the question a bit.
That's okay. Wilma, I'll try to unmute you.
Okay, sorry. Is that better? Is that fine?
That's fine.
Yeah.
Hi.
Thank you. There were so many exciting things that you talked about that it's frustrating and it would be a very long, interesting afternoon to go on with this discussion. But there was one thing I wanted to focus on that hasn't come up in a long time, and it's come up constantly, is the hand movements. And I don't know if you're familiar at all with the work that was done, I guess it was in the 70s and 80s. I don't know if it still continues. It was how I started my career, working with Norbert Friedman, who everybody knows and who was active leading here. And there was work on distinguishing different forms of hand movements and their relation to different forms of language. So they are you familiar with this work?
Well, not familiar, maybe too much, but I know that work. Yes, of course. I'm hand-centered in a way.
Well, so is everyone is. Everyone is. Some are smaller. Some of the movements are smaller. Some movements are bigger. And there's been lots of research. Italians are really, really very expressive. And English are smallly expressive, but equally active movements in pubs. They do.
It has been pursued by Susan Goldie Meadow, this kind of research. Yes. I know that. The trail, yeah.
We started it, and I started in 1975 doing this with Bert Friedman, scoring, and it was the first work I ever did in this way, scoring different kinds of hand movements. And there were distinctions between, I'm going to be fast, there were distinctions between depictive, which is staircase, spiral staircase,
yeah.
And my head, my breath. And body touching, which had different significance, and rhythmic speech-related hand movements, just like that. Rhythmic speech-related hand movements, no depiction, no particular meaning. We did a study that demonstrated that people who used more of these rhythmic speech-related hand movements that were not depictive, told stories that were more vivid and expressive. And that there's all kinds of stuff going on in the brain that we don't understand at all. I don't know if it's understood now. I think it's a great mystery of speech generation, of how to generate speech in relation to what hands are doing and tools and how all of this works. So I would like to understand that better.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I've been, since the very beginning of my acquaintance with the brain, totally fascinated by the hand, particularly because when I joined Giacomo Rizzolatti's group in the late 70s, in 79, I was a medical undergraduate student back then. He was starting investigating how the brain controls hand grasping movements. But then after the discovery of mirror neurons, it was Giacomo who first had the idea to tie this mechanism with the gestural origin of language, connecting it with Alvin Lieberman, very controversial. I'm sure Ray would have a lot to say on the premotor theory of speech perception and the like. As you said, it's quite a mystery why we need to constantly accompany our linguistic utterances with hand movements, which are not arbitrary. They are totally non-arbitrary, as your work beautifully, pioneering work beautifully uncovered, but they are semantically related in a very complicated way. My guest feeling has always been that this accompaniment of end movements, it's a kind of emotional basso continuo, so to speak. So it's an emotional underlinement of what the words are meant. It's not the only one. We have prosody going hand in hand with it. But I think it's strongly related to emotion. This is what I could say. And what has been recently uncovered in Parma, by the way, building upon the notion put forward by Stern of forms of vitality. So forms of vitality, according to Daniel Stern, it's a kind of emotional prosody that accompanies words, bodily movements, and the like. And the region in the brain that systematically activate when you factor in forms of vitality, be it with prosody, be with the style with which you produce a transitive action or even a communicative action, is the dorsomedial part of the insula. The insula is a brain region that, broadly speaking, connects the inner world with the external world, bringing the two together. And that part of the insula, I'm not particularly fond of neurophrenology. I try to reduce at the minimum my speaking of localizing psychological function in a given region of the brain. But of course, I mean, when you describe brain activity, you find activation in different places. So the place that systematically turn out to be activated is the insula. When we want to measure the influence of the affective prosody of words, actions, and communicative hand gestures. I don't know if this answers to your question. I hope it does.
It helps a lot. Thank you.
Thanks.
We basically have 4 minutes left. I don't know if you'd indulge us for maybe 15 more minutes. We might be able to get through the rest of the questions, or we should end on time. Although that's an impossible question to ask someone.
Fine with me, no problem.
Okay, why don't we take 15 more minutes and we'll finish the questions that are currently up. David Lotto, you're next.
Okay, I'm unmuted. I think these can be quick. Two questions. First, that little icon that you had in your PowerPoint of the guy's head with all the leads, is that actually what a high density EEG looks like? And so a couple other questions.
Yes, that's 128 channel.
100, okay.
Our geodesic headset.
All right. What kind of information do you get from that high density EEG, and how does it compare to what you can get from an fMRI?
Okay. Basically, you lose and gain with both techniques. When you use EEG, you're measuring the electrical activity of the whole of the brain, and you can do two basically approaches. You can monitor the way all the neurons of the brain synchronize or desynchronize in a variety of frequencies, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, or alternatively, but you have to repeat the same stimulus many times in order to maximize your signal-to-noise ratio, you can record event-related potentials. Then this event-related potential, for example, N400, when something violates your expectation, people systematically record this negative potential, which occurs 400 milliseconds after you deliver the stimulus. That's why it's called N400. Then you can do something further. Try to localize the source in the brain of that potential that you record from the surface of the brain. And then things get really troublesome because you have a wonderful temporal resolution with EEG, which is in the order of milliseconds. one single action potential fired by a neuron lasts about that lapse of time, 1 millisecond, okay? But in terms of spatial resolution, the technique is very poor. We try to localize the source of our ERPs when we study ERPs with 128 channels. Some people claim it's enough. There is software being developed by colleagues that allows you to say, well, this is in the insula, or this is in the prefrontal cortex, this is in the occipital lobe. Other colleagues said, you need at least magnetoencephalography. You need 500 channels. Okay, that's one thing. When you do fMRI, you infer the activation of the brain indirectly. You're not recording the electricity, the electrical activity of the brain. You localize where the blood goes mostly into the brain. And the spatial resolution is much better. You can safely say what happens in a voxel, which is the unit of measurement, which has a few millimeter of size, but in terms of temporal resolution, it's very poor. You need minutes, because you require at least many seconds. You require that because of your stimulation, the blood flow increase in that voxel, and that is washed out before you can submit your participant to a new sort of stimulation. So EEG is direct, very good temporal resolution, very poor spatial one. fMRI is indirect, good spatial resolution, very poor temporal one. The ideal is to combine the two. Very few people can do it. It's easy to say it, much more problematic to do it. I hope I answered your
question. Yes, thank you. That was wonderful. Okay. I did have one other quick thing.
Go ahead. Sorry, Larry.
Okay.
But David, sorry.
Okay. About the evolution of objects as symbols.
Yeah.
The hand axe. Are you saying that that's some kind of, is that, that's pre-symbolic, or that can be, or that can be fully symbolic, or partially symbolic?
Nobody clearly knows. It has been suggested that it can be both.
Right.
I mean, for example, if you consider that in order to manufacture that hand axe that mm-hmm. has been found in Suffolk, in England, and has been dated as being made 200,000 years before present. Apparently, with stones, with materials that had to be brought in the area where it has been found, together in some burials of human bodies, 120 miles away. So some people speculated that very few people could afford that. Very many people probably contributed to the making of it, but very few people were wealthy enough to possess such an object. So if it was not, properly speaking, symbolic, it was today like owning a Jaguar or a Ferrari car, a sort of status symbol. So in a way, it was already symbolic.
Right.
Yeah.
Good, thanks. That's exactly what I was thinking, right?
Yeah.
Anne?
Thank you for your very interesting paper and presentation.
Thank
and you. The question may be the result of a misunderstanding of what you've been saying, so I hope you'll correct what I'm about to say. And it's a question about how novel actions or novel habits ever arise in practice theory. So one way to think about what you're presenting is that you're sort of bypassing mental representation in the mind in favor of a more direct brain-body connection. And so then how does something novel arise? Because on the one hand, you've said that symbols are not a later externalization of pre-existing symbolic thought. But on the other hand, the creation, any kind of physical action towards some object in the world, you've said, requires some ability to imagine what you want that object to do, what it's going to look like in the future. Yeah. So it seems to me sort of circular and unclear about how a new habit would ever arise.
Thank you. Very clear. I'm not challenging the notion of mental representation, as I said before, answering another question. So I'm not, I'm against radical enactivism, okay? Mm-hmm. So, however, when we speak of mental representations, we bring up a level of description that doesn't necessarily entail having an equivalent ontological status. Or let me say probably the most radical sentence so far. I don't believe anything like the mind exists. I believe what exists are mindful practices, mind features, but the mind is a word, like the body is the word, like, so I think there are words and the brain body and the world out there. And so this brain body produced words. By means of words, we created concepts, thoughts, categories, taxonomies, lists, and the like. And among this very useful notion, we have the notion of the mind. But I don't think there is a site for the mind in a particular area of the brain, like I don't think there are specific neurons that are the neuron for consciousness, like people like Crick and Koch envisioned in their astonishing hypothesis a bunch of years ago. I think consciousness is the outcome of the relation between the brain body and the world. And even speaking of emergent properties, to me, sounds a bit like a rhetorical shortcut. Because then you really, if you don't want to do your homework properly, you have to justify what the notion of emergence exactly boils down to and how does it relate to the physical ontology, the monist physical ontology that I embrace. So as I said, I'm a relational realist. How do you invent something? Well, Mozart, for example, let me go back to music that was brought up by Ray before. I mean, Salieri was a very distinguished musician at the court where Mozart arrives. So Mozart does not create his music out of a pneumatic void. I mean, he elaborates, he always starts from something. So invention is never something that is created out of nothing. Maybe God can accomplish that if God exists, which I seriously doubt. So creation is always a modification, an elaboration, a novel instantiation of something that pre-exists and that nobody saw before the creator. You could do something with something that existed before. So that the creation of the symbol is of course the outcome of a representation like anything else. I don't think that mental representation are required only when we think about the creation of symbols. I mean, mental representations, with the qualification I tried to give you before, guide all of our behavior. I don't know if I answered your question.
Well, it sounds like you're saying it's turtles all the way down. You know, how did the original mental representation that then becomes...
I think a non-linguistic animal has the mental representation of his prey. I said that before, which is of course a different format. For example, if I want to explain you how to go from my house to the opera house in Parma, I can represent that contentful information using a variety of formats. We can walk together, which is probably would be the most pleasant way to guide you through my city. I can fax you, I would have said 20 or 30 years ago, the route on a map, we could sit together and I could move my finger of my, on the map of my city with you sitting beside me, following the movement of my finger, or I could verbally tell you the instruction, oh, don't be afraid, you won't lose yourself as soon as you get out for my place. Keep walk straight for 10 blocks, then you reach a big square, take a right, and after a while you get to the opera house. So the content is the same, how to guide you to the opera house from my place. I use different representational formats. The same happens in the brain. Some of the representational format that we employ when we speak or when we use language were used already before. That's my idea. There's nothing totally new when language comes about in our brain. We use differently, we exact, we reuse, or we neurally recycle, as Stan Dehan would put it. We use different wordings, but we basically use the same meaning. I think it's...
I understand what you're saying. I wanted to just, something was rattling around in my head, an old experiment from graduate school that I sort of remember in reference to what we've been talking about, that there was a study that apparently was taken around the world to different cultures where there were people were shown two drawings, one wavy like this, a wavy line, the other was a jagged line. And people,
I mean, Ramachandran reinvented it, designating it Kiki and Bubba, but was originally found
the Bluma and
German Gestalt psychology. Right. It's the Gestalt output, this. I think this is incredibly telling. I mean, the merge of, it's very consonant with what Dr. Bucci was saying before. I mean, the merging of the movement, the affective quality, and how a jagged scribble can bring along such a rich, phenomenal experience when you ask people, how do you react? I fully agree.
Thank you.
Larry, I'm seeing that you withdrew your question. And so we have our last question, Darlene. You want me to help, Darlene?
You have to mute you, Darlene.
I see, okay.
You're all set.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
It seems to me that there are different languages allow different, there are certain things that cannot be described in one language and yet in another language are very, you know, like if just the most simple one is the word snow. There are, you know, 10 or 20 kinds of snow in one context, and another context is one word. And that goes on in multiple ways. So it seems to me there's something about development where language, culture, transgenerational issues, and emotional issues, what is emotionally articulatable in one language or even experienced in one, it may not be translatable to another. And I think if you grow up in one language, you don't understand it unless you live in multiple languages. There are certain things that are not translatable. And I think emotionally that's true also. There are certain things emotionally that developmentally, depending on your experience, may or may not, you may not even understand the possibilities. So it just feels to me that needs somehow to be considered in this discussion. Yes,
I fully agree with you. There was an older colleague of mine telling me, if you're not German, you can't properly do psychopathology. Because, and I think he's partly right. I mean, the nuances in describing phenomenal experience are richer in Germany than in Italy, of course. For example, I'm not too deeply into English to there to make a comparison between the two, although the English dictionary is much thicker than the German one. But he was specifically mentioning the words that we normally employ to describe mental illness, psychopathology. So you see, I briefly mentioned this aspect at the beginning of my talk. I think that you can keep both this huge, enormous, wonderful diversity among different languages, which boils down to different Weltanschauung, different views of the world, and the incredible difference and diversity that you are finding among people, even when they speak the very same language.
Exactly.
This dimension cannot be neglected. I would say more, they must be fully addressed if we want to understand who we are. The point I was trying to make, that in order to address those unavoidable issues, we can profitably use also natural sciences. If we bring natural sciences on the table, it doesn't necessarily imply that we automatically have to sacrifice this diversity, this difference, this inter-individual. I'm the first to recognize that we are still too crude and coarse, most of the time not able to factor in inter-individual variability, for example. All brain imaging experiments are the outcome of averaging the brain of individual. We try to sample individual as similar as possible in terms of instruction, gender, age, education, and the like. You can build subgroups about a variety of topics like political inclination, according to the study you're up to, but we can do a lot more than that. But what I mean is that we can do a lot more about that, but bringing in a further vantage point, a further level of description, which is in particular that offered by cognitive neuroscience, doesn't necessarily imply that from that moment onwards, we lose difference, we lose cultural specificity, we lose the role of social construction in developing concepts, we lose who we are. I mean, it can be like that.
But also,
it can be like that. There is something I define neurohubris. There are colleagues of mine that don't think they need to entertain the dialogue with anyone but with colleagues, because neuroscience will provide the answer to all the questions. I think that's garbage. I don't share that view. And there are many others like me who don't share this view.
I don't either, but I think the issue of the mother-child relationship and what is possible with one mother and may not be possible with another has profound impact. And I think part of analysis is often...
I couldn't agree more.
Opening up new relational possibilities that were never experienced before or even imaginable. So,
yes.
And that can be the most, you know, the most powerful aspect. It's almost nonverbal, but it's very profound.
Yeah. I fully agree. One of the most puzzling aspects in this domain to me, not just for me, is that of resilience. Because sometimes you are talking with some of your colleagues, psychoanalysts, psychiatrist, when you reconstruct the life history of some individual, it's really hard to believe that in spite of the terrible life they suffered, they emerge out of those devastating impact, being able to live on average a psychologically competent life. They were not turned into sociopath or psychopath. And it's maybe a brother or a sister failed dramatically. So it's really difficult from the point of view of the brain body to address this topic as we speak. It's one of the biggest challenges we want to face in the coming years, I guess.
Well, thank you so much, Vittorio. You know, for several years now, Paolo has been trying to get you to come to the group.
And I'm sorry.
I'm so delighted that you're finally.
Yeah.
Really, and I think I speak for the group, and they can all wake up to. Thank you so much for your generosity and your time and your answers and your presentation. Truly wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure, and let's hope that sooner or later we maybe eventually gather around the table with a glass of wine and keep discussing about this.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Bye to everybody.
Yeah. I also wanted to say I'm happy to leave this on. I know people, if they want to say goodbye, I'm happy to leave the room open for a while so people can say goodbye if they want to chat with one another.
Goodbye to everybody, and thank you again.
Goodbye.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody. Yes.
Bye. Goodbye.